and we are not spending nearly enough time on Jewish law, which is probably a mistake in my setting up the syllabus, but I thought that we would at least spend today on it. Before doing that, I did want to mention something interesting that I discovered while I was reading a magazine in the dentist's office yesterday, and that is, probably all of you have observed Auntie Anne's pretzels, right? The founder of that was raised Amish. Her family eventually shifted to one of the sort of semi-Amish group, the so-called black car Amish, who allow cars as long as they're black. And then I think from that she ended up Mennonite. But her initial upbringing was Amish, and she successfully started a successful large franchise business. That was sort of neat. So now you've read stuff about Jewish law. You've presumably read my chapter on Jewish law and a bit of the sources, and I thought I would start by taking questions or observations or things that occurred to you from that you thought were interesting about Jewish law. Yes?
I was trying to find out where it kind of takes some of this biblical law and kind of use it around it. And it has resources, we have that quickly by the industry,
yeah.
But I was wondering if you could, if you just happen to have it, where those sections are, because I just stumbled into more.
Yes. That is one of the examples would be the question of stoning the disobedient son. And I may even have, let me see if I've actually got the specific reference for that. Page 365 is my note, but the note there doesn't say which of the three volumes, Maimonides. I think, unless it's Mishnah, I'd have to look it up. But page 365 of something has that. And my guess is this is a discussion in Maimonides, and then you'd have to check which of the three volumes of Maimonides it's in. But I just noticed that I happen to have that page number there. But that's one example, and I was going to discuss that if I get to it, which we'll see if I do or don't. But other things from what you read that you found interesting about Jewish law, are there questions about? Nothing? Yes.
In your reading, there is a brief little bit in the marriage section about the rain and how the rain was.
Yes.
Sure.
I can explain both what happened and my possibly incorrect interpretation of what happened. What happens is that you've got these dispersed diaspora communities, which are legally independent in the sense that the ruler is willing to let them enforce their own rules on their own people. And they may or may not have anybody in the community who is a halakhic scholar, who is learned in the law, unlikely to have many such people. And so how do they handle law? They have communal authorities, sort of the equivalent of the city council, as it were, the mayor or something set up. And there's then a whole question, first, to what extent can they enforce rabbinic law, given that it's not clear they're competent to do it, and to what extent can they make their own law? And there are a number of arguments offered for letting them make their own law. One of them is the claim that if you look at the biblical sources, the king of Israel is doing things that wouldn't be permitted under rabbinic law. So the argument is you've sort of got two parallel sets of authorities. One of them is the Sanhedrin interpreting Torah, but then the other is the king. And there's this, to me, rather bizarre argument, which is that there's a passage in the Old Testament which looks as though it is describing all the horrible things a king will do. It's in the form of Samuel warning the people of Israel against having a king. People of Israel don't have a king. They've got prophets. They want to have a king just like everybody else. And so here's what Samuel says. And he said, "This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself for his chariots and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties and will set them to something his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. And we will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen. And the Lord will not hear you in that day." Sure sounds like he's arguing against it. But the interpretation is, well, the Bible says the king can do all these things, so the king can do all these things. And then the argument is, we don't have a king anymore. The communal authorities are the nearest equivalent. And then where part, there are a number of places where they drew the line on what communal authorities could or couldn't do. And one of them was the distinction between mammon and Isur. And mammon is basically the law between men. Isur is the law between man and God. And the argument was that the arrangements between men can be modified by men by agreement. That's sort of like freedom of contract kind of approach. The communal authority is not exactly a contract, but it's sort of metaphorically, like we after all make the same metaphor of a social contract. So therefore, the communal authorities can modify the rules between men, but they can't modify the rules between man and God. All right. Now the question comes of marriage, that the requirements in religious law for marriage are very easy. Basically, it is two witnesses' consent and the groom giving something to the bride, traditionally a ring. The age of adulthood for women is 12 and a half. The one of the things, it's a tangent, but one of the things I've noticed recently is there's been a big flap over a judge somewhere who gave a very low sentence to a man who had sex with a 14-year-old who later killed herself. And all of the headlines refer to him as raping her. What they actually mean is statutory rape. That is to say, what they mean is what is in the normal sense consensual sexual with somebody who is underage and therefore not held capable of giving consent. She's a year and a half above the age of adulthood in traditional Jewish law. So that one of the odd things about our society is that we have a very elevated age of adulthood compared to a lot of other societies. So your parents, you've got a 13-year-old daughter. The 13-year-old daughter thinks she's in love with a young man who is clearly unsuitable. You would like to be able to make sure she doesn't marry him. Under religious law, you can't. All she's got to do is to go off with him and two witnesses, and he gives her a ring and says the appropriate words, and they're married. Not a damn thing you can do about it. So what's the solution? And there are at least two solutions they come up with. And one of them, which I regard as sort of entertainingly bizarre, is to say, well, marriage, see, the problem is the Isur. The problem is that whether or not, that marrying somebody when you are already married is a violation of religious law. So if the communal authorities say you can't marry unless you have your parents' consent, or you can't marry unless some other conditions, and somebody marries despite that, and the communal authorities say you're not married, so then that person marries someone else. That's a violation of religious law because she's not entitled to marry someone else she's already married. Right? It means that their children will be momzers, which gets mistranslated bastards. But strictly speaking, the children of a couple who aren't married but could be are not momzers and have the same legal rights as the children of married couples, which is many enough. But momzer is the children of a couple who could not be legally married. For example, if the marriage is incestuous, or if one of them is, if the wife is already married. In Jewish religious law, men can have more than one wife, but women can't have more than one husband. So therefore, what do? They say, yes, marriage is Isur, but the ring is mammon, because that's a piece of property. And the groom can't give a ring to the bride if he doesn't own it. So we, the communal authorities, will announce that when someone tries to get married in defiance of our rules, we confiscate the ring. Since he didn't own the ring he married her with, it wasn't a valid marriage under religious law. So we're not changing Isur. Therefore, so that was a device for getting around the fact that they wanted to control marriage. I think that's my interpretation, at least. And it's pretty clear from the couple of cases I quote. And yet that was Isur and not mammon. And one of the things is they seem to have backed away from that. That it looks as though for a while there were communal authorities courts that were doing that, and then they more or less stopped. And my theory of what's going on is that it runs into a problem with the fact that marriage isn't relevant only within your community. That the woman who you claim isn't married, although you could argue she was, may then marry somebody from another community. They have a different court with different rules. From their standpoint, she is married, and she's pretending not to be, so to speak, and that's a problem. So what they fall back on is the alternative of saying, since Jewish religious law allows husbands to divorce wives, but not wives to divorce husbands, we can compel the husband who is engaged in one of these, in a marriage without meeting our requirements, to divorce his wife. So the idea is the 13-year-old girl marries her 14-year-old, he's an adult too, that's 13 and a half for men, her 14-year-old boyfriend, and the parents objecting have them brought into court, and the boyfriend is imprisoned, maybe flogged, unless he's willing to divorce his wife. So that's the way they... And now, since divorce is part of religious law, if he divorces her, whether or not under compulsion, that solves the problem. And one of the interesting things is that's also the solution that was eventually used for the problem of women divorcing their husbands. That there was nothing in the religious law that allowed women to divorce their husbands. However, a woman eventually, I think it was after about the 10th century, I don't know if this is communal or halakhic or religious scholars, the position is taken that the woman can go to the court, offer reasons why she ought to have a divorce, and the court can then compel the husband to divorce her. Now, there is still a hole in this system, and it's a hole that still exists in religious law, and that's what if the husband isn't there to be compelled. So that you have the problem of, I forget what the term is, there's some Hebrew term for it. You're a woman, you're married. Your husband disappears. Maybe he was out of the, in a foreign country at the point, maybe he died. Or maybe he decided to abandon you. Alright? How do you ever get married again? Because you don't have two witnesses to say that he's dead, which I think is what was required. And you can't make him divorce you because you can't get a hold of him. And you then have, there's some term for this, which is, because I gather it's still a problem in Israel, at least among the religiously orthodox, as to how you deal with that situation. But it is an interesting example of sort of the whole issue of you've got these constraints because the law is supposed to be religious law. How do you work around them to get what you want? And the other bit that I discussed in the chapter, because I found it intriguing, was that I had conjectured that part of 19th century English and American law had exactly the same basic logic to it, that it was, as I interpreted it, law, a weird legal rule whose real purpose was to give parents more control over who their daughters married, which it seems to me is an interesting point if so. And I cite there, I didn't fill in the reference in the footnote, I should, but if anybody is interested in 18th century Europe, Casanova's memoirs are really great fun. That this is this, I don't know, it's a 6-volume or something, autobiography by a guy who was basically a con man, but he was also an author, a scholar, an entrepreneur, a gambler, a whole bunch of other things. And he perfectly open and, you know, about the various things he did, some of them morally dubious, including his love affairs, although contrary to his reputation, that's not what the book is mostly about, but those are included. And one of the early ones is one where he thinks he wants to marry a girl. He never marries anybody, but in various cases he thinks he's going to. And she wants to marry him, and she's pretty young, and her parents won't consent. And they discuss the fact that if he gets her pregnant, her parents will have to consent. So that struck me as an example of the kind of pattern that I was conjecturing showing up. I always find it interesting when I sort of form guesses about what's going on in a legal system and then later find some historical evidence that looks as though it fits the guesses. Is that clear enough? Yeah. All right. But it's an issue for a bunch of other things because there are a whole bunch of restrictions in religious law which were really very inconvenient for the communal law. That in principle, in order to execute somebody for a capital crime, you must have two witnesses who will testify that before the person committed the crime, they warned him it was a capital crime. All right. Well, how likely is that? And so there are a variety of ways around that restriction. And Maimonides says, well, you can claim that you're acting under the authority of the king of Israel, because clearly the king of Israel is described in the Bible as doing, executing people who hadn't, for whom they didn't have it. Or you can claim that it's a temporary emergency, that there are temporary emergencies. And it turns out when you look more carefully that this business about temporary emergencies, you can make a temporary law and never repeal it. That you can have a temporary law that lasts for hundreds of years. It's just sort of not quite a full law, and it could have been repealed, but and so forth. There's a lot of stuff of that sort. And Maimonides has this very interesting discussion where he says, suppose you kill somebody in an indirect way. Suppose you hire an assassin, for example, and he gives other examples of that. Doesn't meet the requirements for capital murder under religious law, so what can we do? Well, he says, I think if I remember, he's got there the possibility of the communal authorities claiming they're acting as the king, the possibility of saying it's an emergency situation, but if all of that fails, you can lock him up and feed him on very little, and eventually feed him, I think it's barley, until his stomach bursts. I don't remember the details, it sounds fairly unpleasant. So you can basically mistreat him in ways that are likely to lead to death, even though you're not allowed to execute him. And why can you do this? This is where I like Maimonides, where he's being a good economist, because if you don't do that sort of thing, somebody else is going to say, look, so-and-so killed somebody, and he didn't get punished. I could do the same thing. I can hire an assassin or whatever. I think he has a couple of other ways. I think there's something like maybe tying him up next to a lion or something there. I don't remember the list, but there are things in which you're in fact killing somebody, but not directly killing somebody else.
So I want to know of Israel history. There's been a lot of cases where kind of they followed in bad times, maybe they're subjugated, and then a lot of religious people say that they follow like God. That's why they're investigating in the first place. They return to this roundabout way of going around biblical law criticized as one of the ways in which they follow like God?
No, not that I'm aware of, at least. That is, as far as I can tell, all of this is pretty much pretty widely accepted. One of my favorite lines I was discussing, as one of the puzzles to me in all of this, is how much they believe in it. That you've got, on the one hand, these very sophisticated thinkers like Maimonides, and Maimonides, in his law, is giving you the detailed rules for things you can't possibly do. So that he tells you when somebody kills someone, he's supposed to go to one of the cities of refuge. There aren't any cities of refuge. There haven't been any city of refuge for about 1,000 years when Maimonides is writing. That was part of the kingdom of Israel. He is then supposed to go be escorted back to the city where the killing occurred, be tried, and if it's decided it's not capital, be brought back to the city of refuge and remain in exile there until the high priest dies. It's sort of a random. There hasn't been any high priest for 1,000 years either. All right, the temple doesn't exist. The temple was destroyed by the Romans in, 200 B.C. or something like that. So it's very peculiar, and it's difficult. He's not a stupid man. If you read the stuff, he's clearly highly intelligent. And is it that he really believes in the religion, and he thinks maybe we're going to get Israel back, and so if I'm giving a description of the law, I've got to describe the whole thing, including the parts that just at the moment aren't available? Or is he just sort of a completist in terms of his attitude to things, and he thinks that the law is sort of valuable in itself in addition to being useful? But then there's the whole question of how people can both take it very seriously and have all sorts of evasions to the law. And the best comment I got on this, when I was having an online discussion with somebody who obviously was an Orthodox Jew, and his response was, the most perfect one who made the law also made the loopholes. So maybe, that's a possible answer, that, God really planned for us to have these rules and then to give us the challenge of, in the real world, living and working around it and so forth. And that's, I don't know if that's the right explanation. I think there is somewhere, there's one of the cases which I mentioned is this disobedient son part. And let me see, I have a list here. I ought to have brought the volume in, but I didn't, because it'd be fun just actually to read a whole list aloud to you. But this is a list of the constraints on being. What the law says is, I can't give you the exact quote, but basically that if your son is a glutton and a drunkard and defies his parents, they're supposed to take him to the communal authorities to be stoned to death. Well, Maimonides, or maybe Mishnah, I think that's where he gets it from, says, in order for it to happen, the parents must both be alive, because it says his father and his mother are to take him there. They must not be blind, because if they are blind, they couldn't say, this is our son who has done this, because how would they know? They must not be crippled because they're supposed to take him to the communal authorities. Well, they couldn't walk. They couldn't do that. They must not be mute or deaf because they couldn't say anything to the communal authorities if they were mute. And they couldn't, I guess, I'm not sure what the hearing part is, but somewhere. And that's because they're supposed to take hold of him to bring him out to say, and this son of ours does not heed us. And furthermore, the mother and father must be identical in voice, height, and appearance. Since part of the phrase in the Bible is, he does not heed our voice. Well, it isn't our voice if it should be our voices. Furthermore, Maimonides, at least, and again, I think he's getting this from Mishnah, I'm not sure, says that there are only 3 months in which you can do it. Because when he's under 13, he's a minor, and therefore some, I don't know quite where he gets this from, but somehow not responsible. And at 13, he might impregnate a woman, and in 3 months, you might know she was pregnant. And once that you know she's pregnant, he's a father and not a son, and therefore the rule for the disobedient son doesn't apply. Now, why it applies to all the sons who haven't impregnated a woman, Maimonides doesn't explain, but somehow this is a restriction. And furthermore, he must eat meat and drink wine because he's supposed to be a glutton and a drunkard. And my memory is that it's more detailed than that. He's got to eat meat, if I remember correctly, that's neither raw nor properly cooked. And I forget where that comes from. But if you trace this stuff through, it's things like somewhere else in the Torah they describe a glutton as doing this or a drunkard as doing this. Therefore, we're going to interpret that as being read into the drunkard and glutton here. And there are a bunch of other things where essentially, I mean, I guess it's not that different from bizarre things that happen in our legal system, but where people are taking the text and sort of parsing out each word for possible implications and pretty clearly are doing so with a deliberate purpose of making it as difficult as possible. And I think, I'm not sure if it's there or somewhere else where Maimonides sort of implies that you're never supposed to do it, but the law is there sort of as an intellectual challenge or to teach you some lesson, which lesson I don't remember, in figuring it out. But that sort of stuff is definitely weird and interesting. So, other things that, yeah.
So, continue on that. So, you say it's pretty clear that you're able to do this. I guess from other things you've got to spark it out so much.
But it's also true that although the Torah has a noticeable amount of law, it has nothing like a complete legal system. So a whole lot of it is going to be rabbinic law in terms of the rabbis figuring out what they think is implied by all of it. But then they have a variety of grounds on which they claim to some degree, and they're just about how much degree, that you can do things that don't really fit Torah. And that's, you know, the fence around the Torah, which is to say we can forbid things the Torah doesn't forbid in order to keep people from getting even close to doing what it forbids. And there's the argument it is better to abandon one letter of the law than all of it. And if we therefore have to do something the law forbids and otherwise the community will be destroyed, then we should do it. And there's the argument that in order for us to maintain the law at all, the ruler has got to keep giving us permission to enforce our own law, but if we don't do certain things, he'll stop doing that, and therefore we've got to do those things. No, the authorities are the communal authorities. I think that's a matter of saying that the communal authorities have to do certain things in order to preserve the community, even if those things seem to be forbidden.
From the stoning the child, the son, it seems like you still, even if it's not the government, you still have to give
them. But the authorities in question, presumably in the original version, would be the religious scholars, would be the court, the Sanhedrin, pre-Sanhedrin, but whatever kind of court Israel originally had, I don't know what.
Well, I guess my point is, they might still say no, he's not enough of a bad person.
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that the text of the Torah, as I remember, implies that. It's much more take it to him, tell him this, and they'll stone him. I think, but the. So, other people with things that you read that you thought were interesting or were puzzling or intriguing about all of this? Because this is one of the places where you've actually got the primary sources to look at, and that makes it, in some senses, more interesting than some of the others. Let me sort of run through. I've got more than a class worth of notes, and I don't know which ones I'll do, but I wanted to start by pointing out that if you look in the Book of Torts, which was one of the three volumes that you're supposed to be reading some chunk from, that theft and robbery are torts. They're in the book, what's translated as the Book of Torts, and as far as you can tell, they are privately prosecuted, and the penalty is not imprisonment, the penalty is a payment to the victim. That it is a good thing if the victim also forgives you, but that's not a legal requirement, though it's a moral requirement. And that although there are things which are punished by things like flogging or execution, mainly religious offenses, also murder, that there seems to be a sharp separation between offenses that result in money payment and offenses that result in corporal payment. So there's one point where he's saying, I think it's a theft, if the theft is so, there's some minimal theft below which you don't owe compensation to the victim, and in that case you get corporal punishment. So you've done something immoral in stealing a trivial amount, and the, I have to find out exactly where it is, but I think I think you're getting beaten or something of the sort. But in any case where the penalty is that you have to, the normal penalty for theft is that you must both give the owner his property back and pay him a fine equal to the value of the owner. So it's a double penalty in effect for theft. For robbery, it's a single penalty, oddly enough. Robbery is less serious than theft. Any plausible argument for why that might be the case? What's the fundamental difference between robbery and theft?
One of them is more sneaky, one of them involves force.
One of them is secret and one of them is open, basically. This is also the Icelandic distinction, as we'll see later. Yeah?
Trauma, and along those same lines, trauma to the victim.
But that would be a reason why robbery should be more serious. But robbery gets a lower penalty than theft, not a higher penalty.
Well, maybe it's more, I don't know, morally turpitude-based.
Yeah?
Yeah, maybe it's more like harmful to the person that trusts someone and is betrayed than someone that is just flat out.
That would be one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is think about probabilities. That if you rob me, I know you robbed me, so I can go to the court and do something about it. But if you stole it, I don't know who did it. So maybe the argument is to make up for the fact that often you will never get convicted. This is something we don't have in our tort law, but it's a little bit of a puzzle why we don't have it, why we don't say if you have a tort where we often don't know who committed the tort, that when we do catch it, maybe we should scale up the punishment. Yeah?
Also, like, you know, theft would probably be from, like, your home, right? And that's, like, you know, home generally have, like, a special legal status in a lot of... I don't know what you're talking
about. So. It could be, but as far as I know, the legal requirement doesn't cover that. But in the Icelandic case, which is an interesting parallel, theft is shameful and robbery is not. So that there's this bit in Egil's saga where basically Egil ends up killing a whole bunch of people because he wants to be a good moral person. And therefore, having stolen their silver... he has to go back and tell them he's done it and then kill them when they respond in the obvious fashion, instead of just going off with the silver, because that would be theft and that would be wicked. And there are other cases that in Icelandic law, it's true of murder as well. The distinction between killing and murder is that murder is secret killing. So that if you're a respectable person, you happen to kill someone, it could happen, now you're supposed to go to the nearest neighbors, essentially, and tell them, I'm so-and-so, I killed so-and-so, his body is out there, goodbye. And if you think about a legal system which doesn't have much like our system of police and prosecutors, it makes sense that life is a lot easier if the facts are known. So if you imagine a system where we say, as long as offenses are public, now it's just a matter of whatever mechanisms we have for settling our disputes. Whereas if you're sneaky, now who's going to, you know, we don't have police to go investigate things. How do we find out who really did it? So I think that's an interesting feature. I know it's true of those two systems, and it'll be interesting. I don't remember looking for it in others, but to see whether there are other systems, and in particular whether the more decentralized systems are the ones where that's typically the case. There are a number of interesting issues which have to do with, in a sense, not treating the robber as morally evil, which seems a little odd. But there are various rulers ones which apply. I'm not sure if it's only robbery or only theft as well, but where you take something and you then improve it. All right? You steal some cloth and you sew it into a garment. And now you're caught. And the rule seems to be that, yes, you've got to give it back, but the owner should compensate you for the increase in value due to your activity. And there's another one where, in the case of robbery, you steal a beam, piece of wood, and you then build it into your house. And the strict reading of the religious law is that the owner gets the beam back, and if your house falls down, tough luck. But it, in fact, gets modified by the rabbinic law to say that, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase, I've got it in here somewhere, but I'm not sure where, that you get to compensate it, to just kind of give him the value of it back instead of taking it out as a way of helping people to sort of admit their crimes and do them. So that sort of is interesting. There's then a bunch of rules of a sort which I assume must exist in our law as well about multiple claimants. So imagine that you steal something from me and then you sell it to him. And now we discover it. Who gets it? What's the answer in modern law?
You're bona fide purchaser. You might get to keep it if you bought it square. You lost it.
Nobody knows. The law, the rule used to be in England that if you bought something in a public market in daylight, you got good title. Yeah? You know?
I just go like that a lot.
I'm sorry. You don't know the answer. It's all right.
I think doesn't it have to do with whether he knew or should have known that it was stolen property when he bought it?
That's an interesting question, because that is, in fact, one of the distinctions in Jewish law. That the ordinary case is the one in which, let me see if I remember it. I think the ordinary case is that, here, I have it here somewhere. Just a minute. Where is it? Too much stuff here. Yes, here we are. No, that's not it. I think the case is that the ordinary case is that the owner gets the property, but I think the owner then has to compensate the person who bought it for the amount he paid for it and can then sue the thief to try to get that money back. And that in the case where the purchaser should have known, where the thief was a notorious thief, where there are a couple of other things, if what was sold was a small quantity of olive oil sold by somebody who was a treader of olives and therefore very unlikely to be actually selling it but in a good position to steal it, and he gives another example like that, that then the buyer does not have any claim because the buyer should have known for compensation. But there's... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Just kind of a quick question. Yes. So, is the Torah the first five books of the
Pentateuch? Yeah.
The Old Testament.
Yeah, I believe that is correct. That's what people seem to be always using it. And I am not an expert in the Bible, so I could not tell you which books that is. But the doctrine seems to be that was all revealed to Moses. And I'm not sure if that's right, but that's sort of the book of Moses, or the books of Moses, and then you've got further stuff that goes on happening after that, which does not, which I guess, is an account of what happened, account of the history, but not a divinely revealed stuff, and therefore, trying to get this stuff back into order because it's gotten out of order. Yes, sure.
Getting back to torts, mm-hmm. or what we consider crimes, including them in torts,
yes.
What are, like, just a very broad counter-argument to that?
Counter-argument. Why wouldn't you want to do that?
Mm-hmm. I have heard you talk about it before.
I understand.
I've had that question, but
yes.
About it
yeah. But I'm the wrong person to argue, because I'm the only law professor in the world who thinks that it arguably we ought to do it that way.
But
one of the talks that I like to give is, should we abolish the criminal law?
Yeah.
But the arguments for Your Honor, what are the arguments for criminal law? right? Or which way? Which side do you want the arguments for? In favor of having criminal law or in favor of using tort law?
In favor of using tort law. Like, so how you said, like...
In favor of using tort law instead of criminal law. The first argument is that in general socialism doesn't work very well. That is to say that criminal law... We're used to seeing socialist used as a political term. If you just use it as a descriptive term, most of the American educational system is socialist, in the literal sense that it's firms run by governments. All right. So is criminal law. That is, that criminal law is a system where the job of finding out who committed a crime and proving it is done by a government employee.
Mm-hmm.
Tort law is a system where the job of finding out who did it and proving it is done by the victim and people working for the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So the sort of first statement would be, well, if you think that on the whole market arrangements work better than government running, that might be a reason. Another possible argument would be, let me go back a step. In a sense, you've got to ask, you could turn it around. You could say, why don't we treat what are now torts as crimes? So what is... It's an interesting general question. Can anybody tell me why we distinguish between torts and crimes as we do in our system? Yeah?
Well, because if we didn't have torts versus crimes, then you would almost have a lower incentive for people that were able to pay civil penalties to just commit whatever the crimes they wanted because they could afford the penalties and, you know, sometimes you're not going to get caught.
Well, sometimes you're not getting caught, it seems to me, is an interesting part. That one argument that can be made is that we use tort law for offenses where we almost always know who did it, and criminal law for offenses where there's a sizable probability of not finding out who did it. And then the argument is that tort law as it exists, you would under-deter if you had a chance of getting away with it. But you could modify that by putting in a probability multiplier in tort law. You could say, if this is the category of tort for which you only get half the people, then the penalty, you've got to make the person, give the person twice as much as the tort injured him. So that would be a possible way of solving that problem. In terms of paying for it, it's sort of tricky because, of course, criminal law includes fines as well as criminal punishments. So your statement would apply already to the parts of criminal law like speeding. Now, it's true, in Finland, speeding fines are a proportion of your income.
Yeah, I think that a couple of countries.
In Germany, too.
Is it true in Germany?
Yeah. I read some story about some guy pulled over a guy in an S500 on the Autobahn,
like 3,000 euros or something
like that.
Can't be for speeding. Yeah. Speeding limits on there are no speed limits on the Autobahn, are there?
Well, no, these days they have like things that can like in certain areas they can add speed limits, depending on the
conditions.
Yes.
On the other hand, in New Zealand, you go to jail for speeding. Don't speed in New Zealand. But then the question is, why do we let people commit torts if they're willing to pay damages? And not all torts are convicted with certainty either. That why not say, well, the reason to punish criminals, we don't want to eliminate all crime, because after all, there's, you know, Posner's example of the starving hunter who's comes to a locked cabin and breaks in to use the phone and the food. That's a crime, but it's an efficient crime. The value of doing it is higher. So one way of getting only efficient crimes is to have a penalty equal to the damage done, just like tort, allowing for probabilities. We've got to scale it up for that. So why aren't we willing to say, well, if you're really willing to compensate, after all, with criminal law, the victim doesn't get compensated at all. If you're really willing to say, well, you know, he robbed you, but then you sued him and he had to give you back what he robbed, and if we only get some and pay you for the damage to your house and all the rest of it, why is that objectionable?
I think with the speeding example, the probability, if you make more money, you're likely to be driving a nicer car and it's a lot more fun to drive it fast. So the probability of...
But the question is the probability of being caught, not the probability of committing the offense. And it's the other way around. As somebody once put it, the top speed of a Ferrari is 10 miles an hour lower than any other country because any other car, because every traffic cop in America is a big game hunter at heart. So I would think if anything, the expensive car is more likely to get a ticket because people are going to notice it. So at least if it's a notice, if it's like a Ferrari, it's something special. Yeah.
But there's quite a bit of overlap between when you can sue for a tort and when someone can be charged for a crime. In fact, like almost any crime where there's a victim, you're going to find some tort theory.
The O.J. Simpson case is the classic case where he was acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and convicted of the tort of killing his wife. And there are certainly cases of that sort. Yep.
Well, the problem is there's a distinction, and there is always overlap, like we just said, but there's a distinction between civil liability and criminal culpability. And with torts like negligence, someone committing it unknowingly and with no criminal intent.
Why does that matter? Why do you want to? They're putting it differently. Mm-hmm. The fundamental difference, it seems to me, is that criminal law, all offenses are treated as offenses against the state.
Right.
You can't be a victim of a crime, legally speaking.
Right.
Whereas tort law, all offenses are treated as offense against the victim. Okay. And then the ownership of the claim belongs to the state for criminal law. It's the state that can decide whether to prosecute. The state can plea bargain, which is an out-of-court settlement in tort law. Whereas in tort, all of that belongs to the victim.
Another thing, too, is because it belongs to the state, that's what I was going to say earlier, too, if you abolish criminal law, what happens if you have no family members that can claim injury? Like if someone murders a homeless person with no family, there's still been a crime that's committed, but in tort law there would be no recovery because there'd be no damages.
I'm not sure that I agree that there'd be no damages. That is,
in tort law, you could sue because who's going to sue?
But the answer is that the individual, including the homeless person, should have the right to transfer to somebody else the right to collect for him, to sell it or give it away. If you think that one of the bizarre features, going back for a step, one of the bizarre features of common law is that tortious loss of life results in no damages at all in traditional common law. And there's legislative law which says that you can collect that if you tortiously kill somebody, other people can collect damages for the damage to them.
Mm-hmm.
But the value of the life for the victim is treated as zero in tort law, which is just crazy. That's one of my favorite examples of the evidence against Posner's claim.
The value would be the pain and suffering caused to those who left
behind. No, that's what it is now. But I'm saying the sensible rule would say your life is valuable to yourself. And that therefore, if just as your heirs get whatever else you leave behind, your heirs should collect the damage for the damage that was owed to you, was a debt to you.
Right.
And the view of traditional common law is that that your claim for your loss of your life dies with you. But there's no good reason I can see why you shouldn't say that claim is now an asset of your estate.
Yep. What if there was no one, like in that situation? What if there was no one that you could assign that to? Then what would you have a state suit?
But it seems to me that you're talking about an vanishingly small fraction of cases
That's
to
true.
Explain a very large pattern of behavior.
That's true.
But
what if in criminal law the state doesn't much like you, right? At the moment, you may not have noticed, but the Director of National Intelligence has not yet been prosecuted for perjury. All right, he lied to Congress. That's testimony under oath. For some odd reason, he hasn't been arrested. All right. So it seems to me that under any system, you're not going to get a system in which that's right. But it would seem to me that if anything, the potential holes in criminal law, one of the problems with criminal law, it seems to me, is, as I put it in my piece, which we'll get later on 18th century English law, if prosecution is controlled by the state, it thinks friends can get away with murder because the king will prosecute them. And so that is going to be decided the other way. And then, in fact, one of the things that struck me that got me into this a long time ago are a number of cases in my lifetime in the U.S. where some agent of government did something which it seemed to me was clearly illegal, suffered no criminal penalties, but did suffer tort penalties.
Mm-hmm.
The first of those cases, which probably is long enough for those who none of you have heard about it, was when I was a graduate student in Chicago. some police came to the at night to the door of an apartment full of sleeping people and opened fire. Black Panthers, people in the apartment. And they killed two people. And the police claimed that the Panthers had shot first. There was no evidence of that. I commented to a friend that I was perfectly willing to believe the police were lying, but I was also willing to believe the Panthers were lying. I didn't trust either of them. And her response was that the Panthers were offering guided tours of the apartment. So I went. When a bullet goes through a wall, you can see which direction it's going, which way the splinters go, and all of the bullet holes
are in
heaven.
It's
going
to be facing outward.
All of the bullet holes are in heaven. That's right. No policeman was ever charged with murder, which they were clearly guilty of, maybe manslaughter, I think murder. A assistant district attorney was charged with obstruction of justice for lying about it, but didn't get convicted. But the city, county, and I think state paid a sizable tort damage payment, settled out of court settlement to the survivors. So that's one of several different cases that I'm familiar with where that happens, where it seems to me that one of the arguments for tort law is precisely because it isn't under control of the state, it therefore gives you a somewhat better tool for controlling malfeasance inside the state.
Yep.
Going back to the difference in criminal and civil.
Yes.
And what I always understood tort laws, the purpose of those is bringing an agreed party back to the place where they were before the crime happened, or the turn out crime, but.
Yeah, the tort.
Whereas criminal laws, it turns from you committing any sort of wrongdoing.
But tort law will also deter.
True, yeah.
And criminal law does not compensate. So then the question is, why does it make sense to have that system? I guess
my answer to that would be, like you said, from one point, yeah, you have this government entity that's inefficient and they're doing this and that, but on the other side, there's also an objective, or supposed to be an objective viewpoint of trying to solve issues, whereas, they're like pinned against each other, like a buyout judge or something.
But I'm not sure I understand that. It's seeming much easier to buy out a judge if you're paying their salary, which after all is what the state's doing. Why would you think that the danger of corruption is greater in the case of tort law than a criminal law? In either case, in criminal law, you can have the judge bribed by the defendant. There's this book, The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano, which purports at least to be an account by one of the major Prohibition-era mobsters. And it's pretty clear that in his business, he's running a small criminal firm, which is one of four criminal firms that are associated. And what are they associated with for? They pool the expense of bribing police and judges. All right, they're independent for the rest of their business. I haven't seen The Godfather, and my guess is it's probably not a very reliable account, given that it's a movie. But I think there is a tendency to greatly exaggerate how organized crime is for a number of reasons. That when one actually looks at the testimony of people, you've got this ceremonial stuff about the mafia or whatever it's called, and then you've got how they run their businesses. And mostly they're running their businesses as small independent businesses and not employees. And in fact, it's not even clear in what sense the Sicilian Mafia is an organization, because the Sicilian Mafia doesn't have any authority structure above the individual family.
Right, so going back to what we said a second ago, regarding criminal law and how,
right.
In that way, let's forget about the buying out judge.
Yes, sure.
Let's talk about the fact that, if you commit a crime, you go to jail. If you commit a civil crime or tort, there's no such thing as jail. You're asked to pay a certain amount of damages or whatever.
Right.
The problem is a lot of times if I have a huge settlement or something, I have a big amount of money I have to pay, I can just declare bankruptcy and not pay. Boom.
So that's very good. So another argument in favor of criminal law is what about judgment-proof defendants?
Yeah,
all right. And judgment-proof defendants is really a double problem. First, it's a problem because if they can't pay the damages, they don't get punished. And second, it's a problem because if they can't pay the damages, there's no incentive to prosecute them in the first place because they can't collect damages. So that's a more interesting issue. And there are a number of ways in which one could deal with that. One could, for example, have a system in which if the defendant is judgment-proof, now you turn him over to the state. And the state pays you a bounty for having caught him. All right. And part of the virtue of that is you would have fewer judgment-proof defendants. Because to some extent, whether you're judgment-proof is a matter of choice. So, for example, I hope you all know that if you're about to lose a major tort suit, one of the things you want to do is to sell your house wherever you are, move to Florida, and buy, have to spend all of your money on buying a house, because in Florida, your personal residence can't be forfeited for tort judgments. So, you didn't know that. You see, you learn useful things, just in case you're ever in that situation. Now, I'm not an attorney. I might be wrong, but I think what I've described is the correct description of the law.
They also have umbrella insurance, too.
Have what?
Umbrella insurance that covers civil liability. Uh-huh.
The...
You can require that by God.
But, so... What I'm saying is that one... There are a couple of possibilities. One solution is the one that I've just described. You could have a basically tort system backstopped by a criminal one. Another possibility, and we're going to get into this in more detail in the 18th century English case, is that one, you could have a system where if you can't pay, you then suffer a penalty, some other penalty, criminal penalty, or your organs forfeit and they get auctioned off in the extreme case. But also, you can have as an incentive to prosecute deterrence rather than collecting money. So that if you think about a situation where I have a way of pre-committing the prosecution. So I pay a firm which agrees that if I'm the victim of certain kinds of offenses, they will do their best to prosecute, to catch and prosecute the offender. In exchange, I get to put a sticker on my door which says Customer Assured Death Incorporated. And now my incentive is now deterrent. And in fact, this is not an imaginary example. This is part of how the actual 18th century English system seemed to work. They had what they called prosecution associations with the prosecution of felons. And an association with the prosecution of felons, and this is not a tort, this is a criminal system. It was a privately prosecuted criminal system. And the question is, why bother to prosecute if you can't collect damages? And the answer is, because you join an association with the prosecution of felons, you pay an annual dues, the money is available to pay the cost of prosecuting anybody who commits a felony against one of the members, and the list of the members of the association is published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So that's an incentive not to commit a felony against anyone. So that, I mean, there are a number of possible answers. It's an interesting question, and I'm not claiming that there's a absolutely clear answer to it. That I, in my book, Law's Order, if you're curious, I run through about four or five rounds of here is a problem. Here is a solution to the problem. Here is a problem raised by that solution. Here is a solution to that problem, sort of back and forth. So I'm not claiming that it's an open and shut case. What I am claiming is that it's not obvious that criminal law makes sense, and that becomes a stronger case when you look at the fact that there have been a whole lot of historical systems which didn't have our system. Yeah.
You could also bring back debtors' prison, too.
You could have debtors' prison.
Like
you could have penal slavery. That was something which has existed in some societies. You can have, as I say, auctioning off organs. There's this series of science fiction stories by Larry Niven, in which starts out when it starts out in our near future, and it starts out with somebody saying, "Isn't it a terrible waste that when you execute somebody, you just bury him when there's a shortage of organs?" So they make laws saying when you execute somebody, your organs forfeit. This is in criminal law. And the only problem is there's still a shortage of organs. And so the range of what's of capital offenses gets bigger and bigger because there's political pressure to expand capital offenses. And that, of course, is one disadvantage. Just as one argument against tort law is you may be worried that the incentive to sue is too large because you can get money out of it. So, I mean, these are all legitimate issues. Yep.
And then also, what would you do about the burden of proof? Are you going to leave it at the 50%?
Yeah, may or may not. That's right. No. You can think of a lot of possible ways you could modify. You might say, for those torts where the damage payment is a multiple because they're low probability, we'll have a high burden of proof. And for others, a lower burden of proof. Yep.
So, if you look at the Jewish law,
yes,
and you have the corporal punishment versus like the fine,
yes,
would the corporal punishment become more akin to criminal punishment? Like, is there,
yes,
a parallel?
It's like that is in the sense that it's not a compensation to the victim, but a deterrent to the defender.
Right. And then is there a distinction between offenses against the person and offenses against God.
Yes, there are religious offenses for which you have punishments, up to including execution. And those are, you don't. And one of the really interesting things, going into my theory that most of these laws, most of these legal systems started out as feud systems and then developed from there, is that the rules for homicide provide that the avenger of blood, who was the person who was the heir of the victim, cannot accept money payment to forgive the offender. So that the implication, at least, the implication, that the ideally, if the offense is capital, the avenger of blood is supposed to execute the person. If he won't, I think the court can execute him instead. But the implication, I think, is that avengers of blood sometimes did accept payments, which, of course, in the feud system, it's called wergeld. It's a perfectly legitimate part of the Icelandic system. And this system, and incorporating it and turning it from a feud system to a court system, as it were, is ruling out that possibility. Islamic law doesn't. Islamic law is similar in some ways. It's, again, the kin. I'm not sure it's just the heir who have a right, but they can forgive, and they can forgive in exchange for payment, as well as just voluntarily. It's one of the interesting differences between those two systems, which in some ways are very similar. Let me mention some of the other bits and pieces. One of them that's sort of fun is Maimonides' discussion of what the damages are for injuring somebody, which is, of course, an issue that we still have. That Maimonides lists five different effects of injury. One of them is permanent injury. One of them is the cost of medical care. One of them is pain and suffering. One of them is your lost labor during the time before you recover. And one of them is humiliation, insult. How do you think he estimates? This is a problem we have too, but he's got a better answer to it than we do. How do we figure out if I'm permanently injured, I become lame as a result of some tortious act by you, or I lose a hand or something? How do you figure out how much damage, what money damages you should owe me?
Oh, you look at how much money you would have made over the course of your life.
Nope.
How much it would be to that person?
How much? I'm the victim. You're the tortfeasor. Something you did that the court agrees is your fault resulted in my losing my left hand. Mm-hmm. How do you decide how much you owe me?
Doesn't he talk about, for example, if the king were to order your hands to be cut off?
That's the next one. You're ahead of me. That's the pain and suffering one. That's pain and suffering. We'll get to there. Perfectly obvious to economists. How do you determine value? You need a market. Maimonides has a market. They have slavery. So the answer is you ask, what would be your market value sold as a slave uninjured? How much less is your market value sold as a slave with this injury? The difference is the amount that he owes. Now, it's not a perfect measure, of course, because it may be that being a slave, you know, reduces your productivity in other ways. But nonetheless, it is a measure. And we've got the same problem. I don't think we have any it's for the solution. Now you're coming to pain and suffering. And now tell us how we measure pain and suffering, because that was neat, too.
Yeah, so he suggests he calculated by, in a hypothetical, a king orders to have your hand cut off, how much you would pay to have it removed and what you pay anyway.
Specifically under drugs. Okay. My guess is it's opium, but I'm not sure. They don't have our anesthetics, but they do have things like opium available. So the question is, how much would you pay in order that the injury be done in a way that didn't give you pain and suffering, even though you lose your hand? Yeah. Which I thought was quite neat. Again, he's sort of trying to imagine. It's a hypothetical experiment. We don't actually get to do it. But nonetheless, he's trying to figure out how, in principle, you set values on things. And that I thought was quite neat. Now, one of the things I also thought was interesting is that he observes what a modern who thought about it would observe. The only difference is it doesn't bother him as far as I know. He says, look, what will affect how large this sum is? Well, if you're rich, the sum is going to be higher than if you're poor. Rich person who wants to pay more to avoid the payment. That's the way it comes out. If you're sensitive rather than tough, if you're, you know, the sort of person who screams every time you stub your toe, some is going to be higher than if you're a really tough-minded guy who's got a high pain threshold and so forth. But again, that's the way it comes out. So he then has, in addition, some estimate of the wages you've lost, the medical care.
and the humiliation, which partly, as I remember, depends on who you are, because different people are sort of more nearly dead humiliated by the injury. I don't remember the details of that, but given the two, which I thought at least were quite neat, were the market measure of injury and the hypothetical revealed preference measure of pain and suffering, which I thought was rather nice. Another bit that's interesting is his discussion of stuff that fits more closely to our tort law, which is things like if your ox gores. Goring means injuring with his horns, using his horns on a person or another animal or something else. And they make a distinction which really corresponds to our negligence distinction. And the term that they use is forewarned. So if an ox has gored several times before, then its owner is forewarned that he is a dangerous ox. And in the case where the ox is, where you are not forewarned, there is one damage payment, which I think is half the damage done, if I remember correctly, up to the value of the animal, I think, of your animal. And if you are forewarned, I think it's the whole damage done. Is that right? You read that part? Yeah. On the other hand, that's for goring. How about if what the ox does is to trample some crops? Yeah?
Well, it depends if it's typical ox behavior. That's kind of where the
distinction is. Right.
And again, that hinges, that also goes to foreseeability, the concept we have.
That's right.
And I think they said if it was like shared land, it was a lesser...
What it says is that if it is some place where, in a sense, the ox is entitled to be, such as on the public highway, then it's a lesser thing. But if he sort of strays into somebody's field, you owe full damages because you knew perfectly well that oxen trample crops and eat food and so forth. And if I remember correctly, I think in the case where you don't have a penalty, I think you still owe something if the ox gets a benefit from it through eating the food. But I don't swear that's right, but I think that's right. But their tort system, there's... Oh, I should say human beings are always forewarned. That a human being committing injury, he's always assumed to be negligent. So if you have two men who are sleeping next to each other, and one of them, presumably very low, very, very fat or something, rolls over and injures the other, he owes him full damages. Unless the other one lay down when the first one was asleep, and then how could he know that there was somebody next to him who he might roll over and injure? Think about some of the other things that are sort of fun in here. There are various issues having to do with essentially conflicting claims to the same property. So that one of the issues that arises is that when you borrow something, the sort of default rule is that your property is the surety for it. There are other ways you can do it. And then the problem is, suppose I borrow money from you, and I then sell my land to him, and I then default on the debt. And people remember what their answer is? Their answer is that the sale of the land is not good because the land was encumbered, and that therefore, in that case, the land goes back to the person that the debt was owed to. Other things. There's a whole fairly elaborate bunch of stuff. This is again a matter of sort of working around the constraints on how you buy and sell stuff. Because the rule in the Bible is that ownership transfers when you pay money. But then the rabbinic rule links ownership to actual possession. This is something we may also be seeing later in Chinese contract practice. And part of the argument is that if you own something and don't possess it, then the person possessing it has an inadequate incentive to take care of it, and that gets you into various legal problems. On the other hand, there are going to be cases where it's hard to do. So suppose you are going to sell me something, but it's something which is at the moment 200 miles away, some property of yours. And the solution there that they eventually come up with is that I make the payment to you, that you have some property 200 miles away, I barter something else for it. Since I could give you possession of my half of it, now it's considered that the stuff belongs to me. That's one of the ways that it was done. And you then end up with symbolic barter, with what's called sudar, where what's really happening is an exchange of goods which we don't have possession of, but I include in it a handkerchief that I give you that I do have possession of, and that's considered to symbolize it. So you're getting further and further. There's an exception in terms of having to have something in order, in having to actually make a transfer. And that's with regard to things on land. So that you then get another way around it, which is that I give you a bit of land plus my caravan that's expected to arrive in a week. And since the caravan somehow is associated with the land, it's not quite clear how, the fact that I really gave you the land makes it good. And then the question is, what if I don't have any land to give you? And Maimonides says, well, that's all right. Every Jew is considered to own his share of the land of Israel. We don't happen to possess it at the moment. So I can give you some of my share of the land of Israel. So you're getting further and further from literal transactions and more into. And there's a lot of other stuff like that, which where it's in effect going from that. One of my favorite bits, which I mentioned actually in the chapter, but mentioned again because I like it so much, is the person who's dying of an incurable disease. And the argument is something which we don't have that arguably should. So that's, let me take it as a general question. We actually have a published article on this, not in the context of Jewish law. Should the punishment for murder depend on the value of the life of the victim? Right? It sounds like an odd way of putting it. But consider the case of somebody who's dying of cancer. He's going to be dead in 2 weeks. Should you get the same punishment for killing him as for killing a healthy 22-year-old with small children? Any opinions on this? Yes?
I think this should be the same punishment.
Why?
Because you're starting to put a value on a human's life, and at
yep.
that point there's a lot of wiggle room required to this person even move in the first place. I mean, he's a mathematician on the street, and you should, you know, allow him to not be part of society anyway. So I think that putting a value on someone's life period is just not a good way.
Well, we put a value on life when you have a tortious loss of life, after all. We don't do it in a very sensible way, but we do it. We put a value on life every time that the government is deciding whether to bank a highway. They're making a trade-off between the cost of making the highway safer and the lives they're going to save. It's true we pretend we don't put a value on life. You put a value on life, don't you? After all, you make decisions about whether you should get your brakes checked, how often to go to the doctor. You put a value on your own life. So aren't you, in fact, if we say that killing the person 2 weeks from death and killing the young mother are the same crime, we are putting a value on life. We are saying the value of the life of those two people is the same. Is it true?
Right, but I mean, it almost seems like you're giving a justification for committing a crime.
We're saying that some crimes are more serious than others. But we do that in other contexts. The punishment for stealing depends partly on how much you steal, so we do say some crimes are more serious than others, don't we?
I think it kind of puts people on a pedestal, like, oh, I'm better than you now, you know, can't touch me.
Yep.
I think that, I don't know, it could be the same because as you have less time to live, you're like, you know, the value of your time could go up to you, like, you know, I only have so long left, I want it to be, you know, I want to make most of it, I mean, assuming you aren't in serious pain or anything, but I also think that as your life shortens, the value of your remaining life to your family members goes up a lot as well. So, I mean,
it might be the other way around.
It could be, yeah. But, I mean, the point is that it seems, you know, likely, not necessarily in every case, but that a person with a short time left to live would value that time a lot more.
Might less. People not uncommonly, after all, kill themselves when they know that they're dying of some unpleasant disease.
It depends on their attitude. Uh-huh. I've heard people that have said, I'm dying and having cancer and dying a slow death. A lot of people say that's the worst way. Just hit me with a car. I want to die instantly. And I've had patients say this is the one gift that I've had is I've gotten to say everything that I wanted to say to everyone I needed to say it to. So.
I'm thinking of two real cases that I happen to know. There was a woman who was a good friend of mine who was dying of colon cancer. And she had told us that she had a drop-dead date. That if she hadn't died by a certain date, she would. And she did. That was her decision. And I can think of another case of somebody who basically said that the one thing she regretted in her life was she didn't die when her husband did. And the last couple of years before she died, she was also very old, she'd be rather not a good. So people vary, but all you're seeing, all of these things are saying is that we couldn't do a very precise job of it. But after all, tort law runs through that problem all the time, that, you know, in tort law, you do some injury, some tortious injury to somebody, and, you know, maybe when you ran over somebody with your car and you crippled him, maybe he really likes being a cripple. You know, now he doesn't have to feel responsible. No, it's possible. It's not very likely. But so the legal system is often making such estimates. And maybe the answer is that it should only be for large differences. I should say the real case. I got interested in this question because of a real law case. And this was a case where a man murders a young mother with two children, kills one of the children, and tries to kill the other who actually survives. And the question was whether in the sentencing phase it was legitimate for the prosecution to bring in testimony, in particular testimony from the grandmother who the surviving child was living with, about how much damage the killing had done, about the effect on the surviving child in particular. And the question is, and it's not to ancient people, but the argument that was being made was murdering a young mother with small children is a more serious crime than the random murder. And therefore, there's a better argument for the death penalty, which was the issue here. Is that right? Is that wrong? Yep.
Well, I mean, going back on, so the whole thing, if I'm understanding, is that putting value on someone's life, right? So I remember looking at, I think 2 years ago in common law, we were talking about the right to die in Oregon, the new law that they had passed.
Right.
And on paper, it seems fine. You know, if I want to die, and then why wouldn't I be able to? But the problem was that it's open the door for insurance companies and hospitals don't want to pay for people to get treatment to say, well, you know, we're going to go ahead and cut off and give you medication. You should have this choice to die if you really want to. And I think that I ethically have a problem with that.
But I don't see how that's going to play into the question of whether when you kill somebody, one ought to allow for it. Anyway, let me go back because we're almost out of time. Just for those of you who didn't follow into the discussion in the chapter, because it's sort of the neat bit of law, that what Maimonides says is that if you kill somebody who was dying of an incurable disease, that doesn't count as murder, so you don't get executed. All right, that's the first step. The second step is that it follows that if somebody is dying of an incurable disease, he can commit murder, and he can get away with it, as long as he doesn't commit it in front of the court. Why? Because in order to convict someone of murder, you have to have witnesses. Why do we believe witnesses? We believe witnesses because falsely testifying in a way to get somebody else executed counts as murder. Ah, but falsely testifying in a way to get somebody dying of an incurable disease executed wouldn't be murder, because killing somebody dying of an incurable disease isn't murder. Consequently, if you, who are dying of an incurable disease, kill her, and the two of them see it, the court won't believe their testimony, because after all, why do we know that you're not lying? Because there'd be no penalty if you were lying, because since you are dying of an incurable disease, lying and getting you executed wouldn't be a capital offense. And that struck me as an entirely implausible, real-world situation, but a rather neat bit of logic chopping, as it were, for thinking about the logic of the law. Yes?
Going back to the value of people's life.
Yes.
Kind of like the first argument, and this, not in the sense that it's the way it ought to be, but it explains why it is that we have equality, and so we don't want to have a system,
yes,
at least in the criminal sense, where we just take value of people's life.
Yeah. Yes. No, it's clear that people are very uncomfortable with the idea of putting a value on life, but my claim is, and that's a fact, and you ought to try to explain it. My claim is only it's not a defensible attitude, because, in fact, in your own behavior, you do put a value in your own life, and the value is large but not infinite, because you aren't willing to bear any cost at all in order to slightly reduce the chance of getting killed in an accident. No?
Well, I think that's where another important distinction comes in between criminal law and civil law. Is criminal law, we are punishing culpability. And so the circumstances surrounding that death would matter, because we do have built-in justifications and things like that. And that would be a big distinction there.
Why do we punish culpability?
Because it's morally repugnant. But there are a bunch of different theories
What?
One of which
is. But no. Her argument works. Deterrence doesn't work because we want to deter people being careless as well as being wicked. If you think about tort law, we don't put tort law as deterrence. It's certainly part of the argument for tort law as deterrence. But part of what's interesting is that it seems to me that as long as you take the sort of what I think of as the standard economic model of the legal system, where we're thinking of both criminal law and tort law as different mechanisms for deterring offenses, then it's hard, I think, not impossible, because you've got things like judgment-proof dependence, but at least it's not obvious why you make the distinction. And one of the problems is that there are, in fact, strict liability crimes, even though we want to pretend there aren't. All right? So, yes.
That's how you can argue that there would be an equal punishment, equal value of that life, because if the crime is equally culpable across the board...
But why would it be equally culpable?
Because if you didn't know the person was dead...
Ah, but what if I didn't know? What about...
If you didn't know it was a mercy killing, then you would have a defense.
What if it's not a mercy killing? What if I really told him to get his money? But, you know, I'm not a very good person, but I'm not a really horrible person, or I wouldn't have killed.
You robbed him and shot him.
I wouldn't have killed a young and healthy person even for the money.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know, this old geezer is going to suffer for another 2 weeks, and I'd like that money.
Well, if we view that as equally culpable and equally despicable as killing someone that's...
But should we? Is it equally culpable?
I think so.
All right.
Because it's cold-blooded murder, or, you know, in that case it would be a robbery that went bad, and that's foul.
But why is it equally foul? Do you have a good theory of justice? And this is part of the problem, is we don't have very good theories of justice. How do we decide other than saying, what does your gut tell you?
Well, what my gut tells me is that if you have a reason, a justifiable reason to kill someone, or even if it is unjustifiable, like mental illness, that's slightly less culpable than someone that kills someone for money or kills someone just because they're...
How about if you have carefully calculated that if you have your brakes checked one more time,
right,
the chance of running somebody down will go down from 1 in 1 million to 1 in 2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And you decided not to do it, but you say that's too small a benefit.
Yes.
Are you morally culpable?
Because then there you have, like, proximity. You have proximate causation issues. And, again, we're kind of mixing criminal with civil here. But the likelihood of you harming someone by failing to get your brakes checked is so remote and attenuated that we can't assign culpability to that.
Well, suppose we continuously increase the probability. You suddenly switch from non-culpable to culpable?
Yes, you do.
So how do we decide at what point?
At some point when it is no longer reasonable for you to fail to take that action.
But what makes it reasonable? Why is it...
Because it's proximate causation. If it's more likely that me not doing something is going to immediately cause somebody else's harm, then I am more culpable.
So the difference between 51% and 49%?
I wouldn't go into assigning values, like as far as numeric values, but I know that we have to draw a line somewhere. And at some point it does become unreasonable, and we do assign culpability at some point.
Well, one of the problems in a lot of these cases, not just this one, is that we're using binary categories, it is or isn't, for what are really continuous variables.
Right.
That runs into all sorts of problems.
Unfortunately, again, when you're trying to come up with a law that works for everyone, you have to.
But if you're trying to come up with your own moral judgments, you may not have to.
Yeah, exactly. You can have
the power of meditation
where you want.
Right. All right. See people Tuesday, and we get to talk about Islam.